News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, you're going to be hearing about the life and career of someone who did not know the meaning of the word quit. Bear Bryant, one of college football's all-time greatest football coaches. Ironically enough, in part two, we're going to be talking about quitting and how quitting is sometimes the best thing to do. And we'll get some advice on how best to quit. Here's part one of today's program. For the next few minutes here on WGTD 91.1 FM, we're going to be exploring the life and career and rich legacy of one of the most famous coaches in history, Paul Bear Bryant. And anyone from Alabama is especially well-versed in this incredible coach's accomplishments. But really, throughout the country, there is a very special mystique which surrounds his name. A new book has been written about him called The Last Coach, A Life of Paul Bear Bryant. And it's published by W.W. Norton and Company. The author is Alan Barra, longtime contributor to The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, The Los Angeles Times Book Review, and many other publications. And we'll be finding out from Mr. Barra a little bit more about what makes Coach Bear Bryant such a unique figure in the history of football and college football in particular. Alan Barra, we welcome you to the morning show.
Nice to be here.
It's certainly an intriguing title which you have chosen. Can you explain to our listeners why you call Paul Bear Bryant the last coach?
I'm glad you asked me that question for a number of reasons, including the fact that the puzzling review I got from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reviewer didn't seem to understand that title and why it's there. Let me explain it. First of all, Bryant was the last of the coaches who had a direct bloodline to the great modernization of college football, which came out of Notre Dame in the early 20s. Vince Lombardi and Bear Bryant were born in the same year, 1913, and both had direct connections to Newt Rockne's great teams, particularly the Four Horsemen team. Jim Crowley was Lombardi's mentor at Fordham, and Frank Thomas, who was another quarterback on that team and was a great favorite of Newt Rockne's, was Bryant's mentor at Alabama. So they both got their modern football training from Notre Dame alumni. As did many others around the country, but Bryant was the last one that can trace that direct connection there. To me, Bryant was the last coach who symbolized the great era of college football, when football in America meant college football. Now, to me, and to millions of others, it still does. The real game is the college game, and pro football is an appendage to that game. Unfortunately, many people in national media see it the other way around, I suppose, because of the visibility and power of the National Football League. It seems like college football is just a minor league, constructed to serve the NFL.
And to prepare, and to prepare
it the other way around.
Right. And now it seems like college football, as much as anything, serves to prepare young athletes for a possible career in the NFL.
Right, exactly. And, of course, that's the way it seems to many people with no direct connection to the college game that simply switch on their TV set for some entertainment. But the fact is that for those people that have followed the college game for a long time, college football could exist very well on its own. They would need no connection with the NFL at all. They care about Alabama and Tennessee and Michigan State and USC and Southern Cal. That's what they live for every year.
Hmm. Let's try to understand for a moment just what makes this career so great and why so many people call Bear Bryant the greatest of all college football coaches. We can start, of course, with the numbers. Just give us an idea of how impressive his numbers are.
He won 6 national championships. I don't think anyone in the modern game is ever going to come close to that again. His total number of wins has been surpassed by Joe Paterno and Bobby Bowden and others, although it took them far more games to achieve that. But I would say there's 2 reasons for calling Bryant the greatest college coach ever. First, and I was amazed when I studied this career, I didn't realize it broke down like this. Bryant was a great coach, one of the greatest of the limited substitution era, when players were required to play both ways, offense and defense. He coached half of his career, 19 years in that era. He coached 19 years in the era of unlimited substitution, and he was unquestionably the greatest coach of that era. He's the only football coach and the only coach that ever will. Again, back to the title, The Last Coach, the only coach that ever will be a star in both eras, because we'll never go back to that again. As we said, the main purpose of college ball now seems to be to prepare players for the National Football League, so they're not going to go back to the old, we have to play offense and defense kind of football. That's just not going to happen.
So it's more of an era of specialization now.
Right, exactly. Bryant complained, I think, in the late 70s, he says, I don't coach football anymore. I coach coaches. You know, back when you had 50, 60 players on your team, you had a direct connection with the players. And a football player was a football player. He tackled. He kicked. He did numerous things. Nowadays, you're not a football player. You're a nickelback or an outside linebacker or a blocking back or something. You have one skill. And that's what you, practically from high school on, that's all you do.
Hmm.
So that's one sense in which Bryant was the greatest. There's another really spectacular argument for Bryant as the greatest college coach. He sharply turned around the fortunes of 4 different college programs, Maryland, Kentucky, Texas A&M, and Alabama. And he is arguably, since he was only at Maryland for 1 year, we won't call him the greatest coach there, but still the greatest coach Kentucky ever had, still the greatest coach Texas A&M ever had, and certainly, of course, Alabama's greatest coach, although that's saying a lot since Alabama had a tradition that went all the way back to the 1920s with Wallace Wade and Frank Thomas. But that, to me, is the mark of a truly great coach. Vince Lombardi comes to Green Bay and sharply turns the fortunes of that team around. That's how you measure, I think, the greatness of a coach.
You compare Bear Bryant to 2 other greats in college football history, Knute Rockne and Amos Alonzo Stagg, by giving each of them sort of a different moniker. You call Stagg the great innovator, Rockne the great modernizer, and Bryant the perfecter.
Yes.
Explain in what way we should think of him as the perfecter.
Well, when you look back on Stagg, by the way, I live in South Orange, New Jersey, and I just discovered a couple of weeks ago that Amos Alonzo Stagg was born in West Orange, about 2 miles from where I'm sitting. I mean, little things like that just tickle me. When I found I was working on my book, I found out that I talked to David Marinus, of course, who did the great biography of Vince Lombardi. When Alabama went in 1933 to New York to play Fordham, Lombardi was not yet on the Fordham football team. I think he had missed registration by 2 weeks. He was probably in the stands watching that day. So Bryant and Lombardi came within a wisp of actually playing against each other.
Wow.
On the football field. You go back to the turn of the century, college football isn't something that you would easily recognize. It was sort of more like a combination of what we would call football and rugby. Stagg was instrumental in getting rules passed, first downs, things like that, helping to establish the forward pass. Rockne is the one tactically that turned the forward pass into a weapon, stressed speed, precision, teamwork. Bryant really perfected most of those tactics. And Bryant, above all, by stressing fundamentals and reteaching the game to youngsters from the ground up, became the kind of coach, as one of his assistants later said, he can take yoursen and beat hisen, he can take hisen and beat yoursen. And again, who's the guy that you most think of in the pros that did something like that? Vince Lombardi, when he goes to Green Bay. There's so many parallels in their careers that it's amazing.
Let's talk about something which you highlight as a great strength of Bear Bryant, but then a little bit of a flip side to his persona, which would seem to be in very sharp contrast to that. You say that Bear Bryant, even more than Vince Lombardi, had a very rare ability, more so than maybe any other football coach, to nurture protégés. And yet you also say that both Bear Bryant and Vince Lombardi were also accused from time to time of brutalizing their players. Help us understand how those two things can be both be true, to whatever extent they were true.
I would say this. First of all, let deal with the brutalizing charges. That they were absolute disciplinarians, I think, is absolutely true. It cannot be denied. I think, to a degree, you have to put that in perspective. You got to go back and look at the context of the time in which they coached. It wasn't like today, where the primary objective was to get a high school kid and prepare him for the National Football League, and that was the lure used to get him to college. Back then, a football scholarship was to a working-class kid a chance for a better life. Maybe the only one he was going to get because parents couldn't afford to send him to college. Most of Bryant's players up until the end of the 60s came from families where nobody had ever gone to college. In fact, in many cases, the parents that hadn't gone to high school or dropped out of high school. So, for instance, the infamous Junction Boys episode where Bryant, back at Texas A&M, they made the TV movie out of it, where he supposedly brutalized his players and wouldn't let them have water. I talked to those guys, and they all said, no, that's the environment we grew up in. I said, you know, Jack Pardee said it was a heck of a lot better playing football back then than pushing my father's plow. You know, looking forward to that for the rest of my life. He said he didn't mind. He was willing to put up with that. So I don't know that you can call it today. Yeah, I mean, sure, if he was a Marine drill sergeant or something, I imagine he'd be like that guy. It seemed to us like the guy in Full Metal Jacket. But, in fact, Bryant was right about this, that football taught this way, and if you cared for the people, for the boys that you were coaching, did build character. You can't argue with the results. I mean, I came up in, let's say, the post-Vietnam era, where it's impossible for me to really understand what football meant to these guys and what Bryant meant to the players that he coached. But you talk to them, and they're absolutely intractable on this. They all claim that what Bryant did was not only teach them football, teach them how the football scholarship could get them through school and better their lives, but gave them lessons, life lessons, like Jack Pardee said. He didn't think he could have gotten through his bout with cancer had it not been for the strength that that Bear Bryant helped helped build in him. Now, it's difficult for me to understand that, but I think people of my generation simply have to, there's a point at which you have to say, look, all of these people must know what they're talking about. Hmm. And it's undeniable that the big difference between Bear Bryant and all of the great coaches, pro and college, was his ability to create protégés. I'm not aware that Vince Lombardi left anyone behind to maintain his tradition, but Bear Bryant's people are still with us at every level in football, pro, college, high school.
We're speaking with Alan Barra about his book called The Last Coach. There are a couple of fascinating contradictions which you probe in your book, and one of them is, I think, especially interesting. You say that when controversies come up about the place of athletics within the life of a college or a university, that people often evoke the name of Bear Bryant as the way that should always be looked at. You say no one tried harder to stress the importance of a football team as a representative of its university than did Bear Bryant. But you go on to say, and yet, no man did more to accelerate the trend toward isolating football players from the mainstream university life. That's a very interesting contradiction going on there. Help us understand how such a thing could come about.
Yeah, thank you, first of all, for having read the book.
You're welcome.
That's amazing. No, you do get a lot of comments and questions from people, it seems, and reviews sometimes from people, it seems, just read the press release and didn't read the book. That's a very interesting point, and I'm glad you brought it up. Bryant felt that his allegiance and the allegiance of all his players was ultimately to the university that he worked for. He loved being considered a faculty member and athletic director, and regarded himself as a teacher. On the other hand, forces that were unforeseen and uncontrollable by Bear Bryant or anybody else started to take hold of college football. In 1960, Rune Arledge, who became the genius at ABC, built his entire career with that brand new network at ABC on the idea that college football could become a major television moneymaker. I mean, what an absurd idea. Who thought? You know, if you watch any of those old broadcasts from the 50s, they're awful. They stick a couple of cameras there, and they show the game, and that's about it. Arledge created the modern football telecast, and of course it was copied by pro football later. The cheerleaders, the agonized look of the fans, the intense look on the sidelines of the coaches, isolated cameras on different players, things like that. And his first game that he used as a prototype was down in Alabama, the Alabama-Georgia game with Fran Tarkenton, the great Georgia quarterback, and Bryant. Those were the personalities they focused on. Bryant knew that television was the future. He didn't know how much of the future. He thought I don't think he ever envisioned it. You know, that it would become the dog that would wag the tail. I think he thought that he could that college football would always be able to control TV. No one envisioned satellite cable and these other things, which get out of hand, where you schedule games, college football on Thursday night. You know, college football games on Saturday morning at 10:30, so you can get a full schedule and things like that. But Bryant was the model, and Rune Arledge and his people admitted this. Andy Sedaris, who does those racy late-night cable movies now, that's the same Andy Sedaris. Andy was the cameraman and producer back for Rune Arledge in the early 60s, and said that Rune always penciled in the Alabama games at the beginning of the year. Bryant was the first, and this is what separates him from the great coaches of the earlier era, like Bud Wilkinson, for instance, his good friend, and a very great coach, of course, in his own right. But Bud retires in the early 60s, and Bryant continues right at the time when TV booms, and Bryant becomes the first big television icon of football, I'd have to say, even really before Lombardi in the pros. Bryant becomes the one football coach that people all over the country can see because of those broadcasts. And that, boy, no one knew where that was going. That helped make Bryant's image, and it helped establish college football.
Among all of his great accomplishments, which we have already outlined, and that very basic devotion to his players, you say he coached as if he had a sacred obligation to make his players' lives better for having played football for him. There is also this thing which you call his greatest failure as a leader, and that is his hesitancy to pursue what he probably understood was something that needed to happen, the racial integration of college football in the South.
That's a fascinating chapter, and it's what separates sharply Bryant's story from his other great contemporaries, Bud Wilkinson, Woody Hayes, and other great coaches in college football. They didn't have to deal with this problem. Bryant did. Bryant's instincts from the beginning. Bryant grew up what they would call, and they still call in the South, if I may use the term, white trash. And he palled around with black kids as a youth and grew up, let's say, by the age of 13 or 14, didn't quite understand why the world he had moved into in Fordyce when his parents moved to the what was the big city, you know, near them, why segregation even existed. Bryant saw, his critics would say later, well, Bryant only saw black kids, white kids in terms of football players. You know, that's all he wanted them for. Well, that's true. He did. He was a football coach. And he saw no reason why he shouldn't be able to recruit black kids as well. He made tentative overtures to integrate the Kentucky football team in the 50s and then later in the 50s at Texas A&M and was sharply rebuffed both times. When he came to Alabama, he started probing immediately into seeing how much he could do. He took Alabama in 1959, a historic game, up to play Penn State in the Liberty Bowl. First time Alabama had played an integrated football team. If it had not been for George Wallace, if Wallace hadn't been an Alabama graduate, and if he wasn't so intent on using the University of Alabama as his symbol, you know, standing in the doorway, trying to block the entrance of black students into Alabama, things like that, Bryant would have, I think, integrated the football team much, much quicker. As it was, I think he had a misguided but understandable loyalty to the university, feeling that if he openly confronted Wallace, that it would hurt the university. He was correct in that. It would have hurt the university, and Wallace was a vindictive person who certainly would have come down hard on the University of Alabama had Bryant openly defied him. So the result was that by the end of the 60s, when Alabama should have been leading the pack on integrating their football team, it was one of the last teams in the SEC to integrate, and also because they had built up such a bad reputation because of Wallace by that time, that a lot of the leading black players simply wouldn't go to Alabama. Now, all of that being said, once Bryant made the commitment to integrate the football team, he did it with complete swiftness and thoroughness. There was no half measures and no token measures, and he was the first major college coach to integrate his coaching staff, and I think he deserves credit for that as well.
Hmm.
His guys are still around today.
Wow. You say at one point, 22 years after Coach Bryant's death, Bear Bryant still intimidates you. I wonder if exactly what you mean by that, and especially if you felt that sense of intimidation at all as you sat down to write this book about this great coach.
Yes, I did, and I felt defiant toward him, and I wanted to show him, you know, darn it, I'm not afraid of you. I was not a Bear Bryant fan. My father's family is from the North, and my mother's family is from Alabama, and I spent a lot of time down there going to high school when I was a kid, and it was very, very uneasy constantly seeing pictures in the paper of George Wallace with his arm around Bear Bryant. In other words, using Bryant and the Alabama football team as a symbol of white supremacy. I was not a Bryant fan, and yet I found myself, no matter where I moved over the years, to Texas, to Chicago for a while, then to Brooklyn, New York, carrying boxes of papers, clippings, magazine stories, tapes, different things, you know. As the years went on, I realized how rich and complex Bryant's story was. I think if I had grown up a fan, I don't think I could have I could have written this book. I had to get perspective on the man and what he actually meant to the game to do that. But all the time, I had that stern face looking down on me, sort of challenging me. And the whole time, I'm saying, "Well, warts and all, I'm gonna tell your story the best I can." And you know, you're not gonna be able to look at me at the end of this and say that, you know, I didn't do the best job I could do.
Well, I certainly have to second that motion. This is a marvelous telling of a fascinating story. The book, again, is called The Last Coach, A Life of Paul Bear Bryant. And it does include, as we've touched on already in this interview, some very, very interesting comparisons drawn between Bear Bryant and Wisconsin's own Vince Lombardi. That among many other interesting things in this book published by W.W. Norton and Company and the author, Alan Barra. Alan Barra.
Currently out in paperback.
I'm sorry?
I should mention it's currently out in the paperback.
Yes, absolutely. It's just been released in paperback, so a very easy purchase for anyone to make and something that every football fan should read. Alan Barra, I appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show, and congrats on a great book.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Here is part two of today's program. We're spending this portion of WGTD's Morning Show talking about, of all things, quitting. Quitting, which is one of the things that most of us want least to do in our lives. We are reluctant to quit. We tend to look down on those that we regard as quitters. It's one of the worst things you can sort of attach to somebody, calling them a quitter. But in fact, we need to think about quitting or goal disengagement, if you want to think of it in more proper, thoughtful terms. We need to think about this much more thoroughly. And in fact, some of the best decisions that a person can make in their own lives might very well involve quitting versus just sort of mindlessly persisting in pursuit of a particular dream or desire. And sometimes it means letting go of something which is not ever going to happen. And sometimes it means letting go of something that you do have, but which no longer gives you the pleasure or satisfaction that perhaps it once did, or is perhaps undermining your well-being in other ways. In other words, we should not be simplistic when we think about or talk about quitting. Hence the value of this fascinating new book called Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. It's written by Peg Streep and by my guest today, Alan Bernstein, who has written extensively on topics regarding changes in life, transitions between various careers and professions. He serves on the faculty of the New York Medical College and New York University's doctoral program in psychotherapy. So he comes at this topic from a perspective of expertise on a couple of different levels. This book is published by Dacapo, again called Mastering the Art of Quitting. Alan Bernstein, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thanks so much, Greg. I'm very happy to be here, and that was a great introduction. The issue for quitting, and I think you touch on it lightly, but I want to talk about it a little more, is that we're hardwired to persist. In other words, there are all kinds of unconscious biases in our personality which keep us going probably long after what we're doing serves us well. And we tend to create all kinds of ideas about why we should persist. But really what they do is protect us from the fear or anxiety of being labeled losers or acknowledging that we made a mistake along the way. And the value of our book lies in helping people understand how they can withstand the psychological assault of being labeled a quitter or a loser. And be able to recognize that it may be in their best interest to persist in a different direction rather than the one they've chosen.
This topic is near and dear to me on a couple of different levels. Most recently, my thoughts about the topic were pricked by seeing a film, which, by the way, I absolutely loved, called Saving Mr. Banks or Mrs. Banks, I'm trying to remember, but it's the film about Walt Disney and the woman who wrote Mary Poppins. And I loved the film, but part of the point of that film is at one point, or several points, Walt Disney is heard kind of spouting what was such a central theme of his life, that if you sort of wish hard enough and work hard enough, your dreams will come true, which has been told to us in song and verse and all kinds of things. But even in the context of this really thoughtfully made and beautifully moving story and film, I found myself just bothered all over again by that myth, which is not proffered just by Walt Disney, but by lots of other people as well, that it's all about not letting anything dissuade you from a particular goal. And because I happen to be a music professor, a teacher of voice, I also think about this in terms of my own students, many of whom have lofty aspirations to someday be on a Broadway stage or the stage of the Metropolitan Opera. And what is one to do with those kind of goals and dreams? Maybe not discard them altogether, but at some point they maybe are dreams simply beyond our reach. I wonder if you could react to any of that, and maybe on top of it, say a word about what prompted you and your co-author to address this matter of quitting in this book.
Well, you raise a couple of really interesting points. I didn't happen to see that film, but in truth, I mean, the probably the most blatant version of the persistence myth is Rocky, and you know the five or six films that have been made after that, which captures a particularly American idea about persistence that you can't be done in by simple things like, you know, fighting a fighter who's much better than you, that if you keep going, somehow you'll triumph. And, of course, the truth is, as you point out with some of your students, some of them won't triumph, and the most flexible and most careful among them will be able to pick up the parts of their career that make sense for them, whether they become teachers or coaches or whatever happens to their music, or whether it becomes a hobby. But the point is to be able to work with a spectrum of interests. Now, both Peg and I left careers. We were both, oddly enough, in the same program. We were both taking PhDs. She was at Columbia and I was at Rutgers, and we were both in the middle of our dissertation. I found at that point that my teaching career was really an error. The part I liked about teaching was being with my students and helping them, you know, select ideas about themselves, and that I had gone into because I loved to read and confused loving to read with loving to teach. at the academic level, teaching is about research. And unless you're prepared to do research, you're going to be teaching English 101 for the rest of your life. And that was not what I wanted to do. And I had to go back to school and start over. And I remember to this day the sense of humiliation I felt at having made a mistake of that magnitude. Now, I was in my 20s, so I was lucky in the sense that people are very forgiving about change in the 20s. But as you get on in my 30s and 40s, it becomes much harder because the weight of feeling that you made an error is so much more powerful. One of the biases that we talk about in the book, and it's very well known in economics, is what they call the sunk cost fallacy. And that means we've sunk so much cost, so much energy, so much money, so much time, so much of ourselves, that at this point it becomes almost impossible to give it up. And, you know, in very practical terms, we face that in everyday life. My wife and I have an older Honda, and I brought it into the shop a couple of weeks ago because a light had come on, and they said, well, it's going to be about $2,000 worth of work. And we had to decide at that point whether it was worth it or not. In other words, were we throwing money at a car that was really kind of going to be an ongoing suck of money, or were we rebuilding a car that would last us a few years? And that's a very simple version of the sunk cost fallacy. But in real life, people face that kind of decision all the time. Have they put in money, time, effort, self into a profession that's not going to pay them back? It's not going to give them the feelings they need to feel motivated and that they're doing the right kind of work in life? Or should they be thinking in terms of starting a new career? Now, if they do want to start, what we've observed, Greg, is that there is a powerful impulse at that point to go into what we call an optimistic bias, that is the orientation towards thinking in the idea that you'll be able to work it out. But we find that it's much more advantageous if you actually write down where you're going to go, what the direction is. That, in fact, as they say in business, you want a pessimist to choose the business and then an optimist to push it through. And that's true as well in career. You want to think pessimistically. In other words, you want to think of the possible gains and the possible losses going forward before you commit yourself to it. But once you commit yourself to it, you move ahead with all the vigor you can. And that's really what's going to replace the sense of loss, the opportunity that people go through. We can't protect people from that. It's hardwired into our society, into our civilization. But we can give them the ability to actually have the fortitude by setting up goals for themselves, by setting up a new version of themselves that they can take into the future.
I want to ask you about one other factor involved in our tendency to persist beyond what is maybe fully productive or beneficial for us. And I love the way you kind of pick it apart, how often our tendency to do that, to be, in a sense, overly persistent,
right,
or is often tied up in several different things. One of them you talk about,
yeah,
is listening to anecdote. And this is tied up in something very fancy-sounding, availability heuristic,
right,
but it has something to do with our tendency to be swayed maybe too quickly or too profoundly, mm-hmm, by an inspiring story or a,
exactly,
vivid example. Tell us,
yeah,
more about that. It really,
yeah,
flies in the face of the way a lot of people like to sort of talk about,
yeah,
life and,
yeah,
the way they make decisions.
I mean, the availability heuristic means that we tend to think most immediately and most clearly about the stories that are around us. For example, if I were to ask you which is more likely to be the animal which does you in, a shark or a cow, most people would say shark, because if you read the newspapers, every time somebody gets bitten or eaten by a shark, it's usually a tremendous newspaper headline. Yet in truth, by far, the largest number of animal accidents are with cows, and we don't tend to think of that, but that's the way it is. So our mind gravitates towards what we call availability heuristic. It gravitates towards the stories we've heard most recently or most vividly. And we do that without a sense of logic. We do that with a sense of instinct and immediacy. Daniel Kahneman talks about this in some of his work, that there are two layers of thinking, one of being quick and instinctive and the other being logical in a deep sense of analytic and thoroughgoing, and what I would call a kind of pessimistic turn of mind, where you actually look at the facts from a deeper point of view of analysis.
We're speaking with Alan Bernstein, and we're talking about his book, Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. And as we've been exploring in these first few minutes, part of the book explores why we are, as Mr. Bernstein stated it, sort of hardwired to persist, sometimes in pursuit of fruitless goals, or maybe in pursuit of goals that we probably should not have begun pursuing in the first place, because they're either unattainable or going to lead us down very dark paths of even self-destruction, perhaps. And sometimes we end up attaining something, but persist in it even past the point where it is giving us any pleasure or satisfaction whatsoever.
Or where the point where we deny that we're being damaged by it. I mean, I have in my practice a certain number of people who have what they call golden handcuffs, who say, I'd like to quit, but I can't afford to, and deny themselves the opportunity to think about what that means or how they can actually work with it constructively. And really what it is an attempt to protect themselves from the anxiety of loss and of feeling they've wasted time and effort.
And I have to say that's one thing that I tell voice students all the time, that I mean, the likelihood, particularly of pursuing, for instance, a performance career in opera, the odds are stacked against you because the opportunities are just out there, are not as numerous as the many aspiring singers. But that in many cases, pursuit of that goal can lead you to all kinds of unanticipated good things and blessings, mm-hmm, in your life, even if ultimately that initial or original goal is not achieved. I suppose that's a different kind of life path we're talking about.
Well, but that's if you're available to look at the options. I mean, one of the examples we use in the book, it's a famous experiment. People are asked to look at two teams who are playing basketball, and they're asked, one team is dressed in black and one team is dressed in white, and they're asked to notice how many times the white team passes the ball between them. And what they do in the middle of this clip that people are watching is a gorilla, a man in a gorilla suit, enters into the middle of the basketball game, beats his chest, and then exits. Now, unbelievably, 60% of the people watching this do not notice the gorilla. And that's what's called, we call that intentional blindness, which is that when you're intent on pursuing something so powerfully and with such vigor, you can actually lose the opportunity to see what's really going on. And, of course, when, you know, everybody imagines that they won't be able to miss this gorilla, but it stays pretty clear at about 60, 65% of the people don't see it, even though you can't imagine you'd be one of them. And so what we're saying about intentional blindness is that we also recommend that you stay alive and awake to other options, as you're saying. If, you know, what else can you do with the fact that you love music and you love singing if you're not one of the one in a thousand that's actually going to pursue a career as an opera singer?
Right. Or be an NFL quarterback or an astronaut or whatever lofty right. goal you might have in your sights.
You've been exploring my dreams, I see.
So your book is not only about why we tend to be overly persistent, but of course your book is also about, as the title suggests, the art of quitting. And I'm so struck by the fact that at various points in the book you will use terms like quitting fully, yeah, or quitting with authority and intelligence, or
right,
quitting artfully. It's so intriguing because it makes us realize that what you're talking about here is quitting that is very different from the kind of quitting that we probably most often hear, yeah, about and don't think very highly of.
Right.
In fact, you discuss some of this, the different kinds,
right,
of poor,
yeah,
quitting.
We have the stealth quitter, a guy who sneaks out. We have the faux quitter, someone who pretends to quit, but in actual fact, they're just engaged at a superficial level. I mean, there's all kinds of negative quitting styles that are not at all what we're talking about. What we're talking about is a full disengagement from all the energy that went into that goal and a re-engagement with a new goal that is actually amplified if people write it down and the steps that are going forward and anticipate what might go wrong. In other words, the closer you come to preparing yourself for all the options going forward, what we call mental contrasting, more likely it is that you will be successful going forward.
Hmm. I really appreciated chapter 3, which is Quitting as an Art, in which you,
right,
talk about letting go on every level, something,
right,
which is not as easy as it might think, especially because,
exactly,
I think a lot of us, if all you know of quitting is the thought of stomping out the door, slamming the door behind,
right,
you, that there's nothing,
right,
easier than that. But you're,
right,
talking about something else, and on a very scientific sort of level, talk about this idea of letting go, of disengaging on various levels, cognitively,
right,
and otherwise.
Right.
Talk us through those levels of disengagement, because this is in many ways the heart of the matter.
Right. The cognitive disengagement is the decision that this is not the right experience for you. And most people can do that in some way. However, we do find there's also a number of other levels of disengagement. For example, there's what we call affective disengagement. In other words, letting go of the feeling of this is the only career for me. And you have to acknowledge at that point you're going to go through a series of steps through that, similar to grief steps. You start with, first of all, once you realize that this may not be the career, most people counterintuitively put more energy into saying that's a mistake until you realize that you're actually working against yourself. And then there's a feeling of blame and anger. Why did this happen? Who caused it? And after that, there is some feeling of sadness and regret. And these things can take place all at the same time. They're not necessarily consecutive until you then re-choose. And at that point, you're free to what we call do motivational engagement, that you move the energy that went into the former career or the former choice into a new direction. What will motivate you that in that? And finally, there's the behavioral reengagement, that you put all your energy at that point into whatever the new career choice is, and you've actually made the shift. But we've defined these four levels because we can't stress enough the power of not wanting to be shamed by having made the wrong choice, that sunk cost fallacy. And so we really talk about, in a sense, moving the energy from the past into the future, and that it's a learned process. It's not an automatic process.
As our time dwindles away, I want to make sure to give you a chance to expand a little bit on one point in the book that I think is also very much worth making, mm-hmm. and that is the fact that the power of positive thinking is not something that maybe we should entirely discard.
Yeah.
But it is so important to use that sparingly, wisely in one's life. As someone who has helped a lot of people try to make decisions related to this, what is the role of positive thinking in how we look at ourselves and our lives and the decisions we need to make?
Well, we refer to it in the book as the optimistic bias, that people tend to, in their wave of optimism, they can overlook the possible things that are going to get in their way. They vastly, for example, overrate how long they'll feel good if they get, say, a new position or a raise, or we ask people to recognize that there is this optimistic bias, and to use what we talked about a little earlier, the mental contrasting, to be able to anticipate the possibilities of things that are going to get in the way and how you're going to deal with them. And we ask people to think of their future goals not in terms of imperatives like "I will do this," but rather in terms of challenges, in terms of "will I do this?" So that they enter into the research mode with their own thinking rather than the black-white, going forward, kind of unilateral "I will." We find that "will I," and the research supports this, anticipates the future.
Your book is full of practical solutions on taking apart the process of quitting, and how quitting is something we need to view in various steps, almost like the steps of grieving in a sense, mm-hmm. and that that ultimately good things await someone if you find yourself in a position where it's really time to, in a sense, reboot your life, redirect it, that quitting sometimes means taking us off of a path that we are better off abandoning. We simply need to be mature enough to look past the little engine that could and the other myths with which we tend to be overly preoccupied. One thing I want to say in closing is I appreciate how this book goes way beyond the theoretical, that you and your co-author have obviously thought in very practical terms, and I suppose that springs in large measure from the fact that you've really sat across from all kinds of people, probably hundreds of people by now, and helped them grapple with this very matter.
That's true, but I also lived it, which I think is the engine that could.
The book is Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work, published by Da Capo Press. Alan Bernstein, thank you so much for writing this marvelous book. I foresee it being very helpful to many people, and I enjoyed talking with you about it.
I enjoyed it. You're a great interviewer.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a look at how math is part of our lives, whether we like it or not, whether we think we like math or not. James D. Stein's book is called How Math Explains the World, A Guide to the Power of Numbers from Car Repair to Modern Physics. On Wednesday, we'll be talking to the author of Given Up for Dead, American POWs in the Nazi Concentration Camp at Berga. And on Thursday, it's